Hi, and welcome to a very special episode of Heart Homework. We're here to offer you emotional support for a chaotic news cycle. But for a lot of our listeners right now, you're feeling pain, you're feeling anger, and you're feeling sadness in the aftermath of the murder of Breonna Taylor, George Floyd, and countless other people of color by the police. Racism is a virus. Protests have erupted in the streets to fight it. And we had pre-recorded episodes before this happened that were dealing with the other virus on our hands, the coronavirus. But we thought it was imperative to do an episode about the unrest unfolding and provide you with the tools to participate, to tackle, and galvanize towards social change, real lasting social change, and fight against institutional racism. All of the ad revenue from this episode will be donated to the National Black Disability Coalition, an organization that supports disabled Black activists who are leading this fight. So we're really lucky to be joined by Jelena Maxwell. She's actually one of my first friends I was lucky to make when I moved to New York. We would see each other in the makeup room at MSNBC, and she was a real hero of mine. And so she's gone on to become a contributor on MSNBC. She's worked on the Clinton campaign in 2016. She is the host of her own show on SiriusXM. She has also written a book on top of all of that is called The End of White Politics, How to Heal Our Liberal Divide. And that book is out on July 7th. And I just couldn't think of a better person to really help us through today's episode. And one thing I really want to make clear from the onset is that at Heart Homework, we take racism very seriously, and we take our work in dismantling racism very seriously. And while Zerlina is here to share her incredible wisdom and her book with us, it's not her job to educate me or white people on how to be anti-racist. That is our job. We created racism. Our ancestors passed it down to us, and we have benefited from it. It is not Black people's job to explain to white people how to be better ancestors. So if you're white, it's not Black people's job to educate you. They're very busy, and they're trying to live and survive in a racist society. It's also a really bad allocation of energy. Yeah. So we need to use that energy for change. And as Audre Lorde has pointed out, there's a constant drain of energy, which might be better used in redefining ourselves and devising realistic scenarios for altering the present and constructing the future. So we are here to learn from you, Zerlina, but this is white labor, and it's white people's work to do it. And if someone is listening right now and feels upset about this, I want you to sit with that. If the biggest takeaway from the 3 minutes that I've spent talking about racism is your feelings, then you are centering the pain of the wrong person here. So, this is something that I needed to be pointed out to me by actually Rachel Ricketts, who's an incredible racial justice activist you should be following, is that actually every space that I've ever been in had prioritized my comfort. And so this conversation will not prioritize white comfort over Black pain. So that being said, in a previous episode with Riz Ahmed, Riz and I talked about how anger is not a problem. Yeah. Anger is a signal. So Zerlina, what is being signaled?
Well, I think one of the things that these protests show is that the rage that people are feeling and the pain that people are feeling, it was right beneath the surface. And I sometimes think of the Black experience and living in a Black body as, you know, feeling sort of the pain of my ancestors, like underneath my skin at all times. It's something that's very visceral. I feel it in my bones, right? And, you know, there's science behind this. There's epidemiologists can tell you, you know, that there is trauma in my DNA, right? Because of what my ancestors have experienced. And so I feel like when people run out into the street after, you know, normally when the police, you know, what's become normal is the police killing someone. Although we just had Ahmaud Arbery murdered by two racist vigilantes in Georgia. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's the kind of thing where the case happens and everybody like releases all of this emotion, this pain that was right beneath the surface. And I think that you have a combination of two different things happening right now. You have organized activists who are always working on this particular issue. They actually are providing tangible ways to which you can reform police departments, or suggesting that we change the funding structure that goes to police departments. Maybe funneling some of that money to schools would be better than making sure that, you know, every mm-hmm. police officer looks like a G.I. Joe when they're in the middle of Main Street. But I think that the other piece of this that's happening right now is that all of this is happening in a pandemic. So I sort of see, you know, somebody said this on TV earlier, and I've been sort of marinating on the point all day. They were talking about police violence against Black bodies as a pandemic that was already taking place, right? I think it was Maya Wiley. So I want to properly say it was Maya Wiley who made that sort of comparison. So it's a pandemic within a pandemic, in a sense. And so just to give you an idea, last year they did the analysis. So last year, the police killed the same amount of people. We weren't in quarantine last year. So that's completely insane, right? I mean, the police have time to kill just too many Black people, unarmed Black people, mind you, during a pandemic when we're all supposed to be in quarantine. So for me, in this particular moment, you have just the release of centuries, really, of pain and anguish. But also, I think you have people, I'm glad to see a more diverse coalition of people coming out and actually saying, no, like, Black lives do matter. And it's clear that we haven't been acting that way, because if they did, what would happen is if you killed somebody who was Black, you would arrest the person who did it. That's normally what happens in all other crimes, except for when the police happen to be the perpetrator. And that has to change. I mean, there is no way for this to just continue on into perpetuity. I mean, I know people are like, dismantle white supremacy, and then that's sort of the slogan, right? But there are ways in which you can dismantle these racist systems, because I always like to think of it this way. Racist systems are made up of people who make racist decisions. And so if you put different people in place, the system itself potentially can be different. That's not true for every single system. Some of them are just inherently racist. Some people would argue the police are inherently racist, given the fact that they were an institution created to catch slaves. And now they're the modern day police department. So there is that historical analysis. But I think the bottom line is that this is great to see a diverse coalition of people all pushing for the same justice for Black people. Because again, that's really what this moment is about. I mean, I don't like it when people are like, you know, all lives matter, you know, they do that, or they try to say, you know, this is, you know, about police brutality and this and that and this. No, it's about one specific thing. This is one of those moments where I feel like we actually get that this time. So that's nice to see.
Right. And you just touched on several points, one of them about the police, I think, is really important. We've seen a shift in terms of the conversation around police brutality, particularly. So Josie Duffy Rice is a really great authority on this. And she's talked, you know, at several points that we're asking the police to do too much. They're not experts in addiction, in mental health, in, you know, homelessness. We are in LA, where I'm at right now, half of my taxpayer dollars go to the police, half. And so to your point, what more could we be doing with that money, and how could we be reinvesting in those communities? And Josie made this really crucial point that a lot of people are saying, well, what happens if there's no police? What happens if there's less police? White communities, that's what happens. There's hardly any policing, right? And so we know what happens. So can you talk about, because I think it's important for people to have action items, right? Yes, it's about examining white privilege and all of the ways that you've benefited from it. But what can, you know, what can we demand in terms of changes?
The first thing that we need to do is we need to elect a new president. I mean, that like, we can't do that tomorrow, but we need to spend every single day from today until the election ensuring that is happening. And I know that it's almost impossible to feel like you can have an impact on that, because, you know, there's Russia and there's all these other factors that could play into the end result. I mean, I lived through it in 2016. So you know, there is no guarantee. But the thing that I always believe is that you leave it all in the field. Like, it's not a sport. Politics is not sports, but if that helps with using that metaphor to explain it to people, I think sometimes they can be helpful, you know, and people can really get it. You have to do everything possible to change leadership in Washington. That's how you're going to adequately deal with the pandemic. That's how you're going to adequately deal with policing. And then you have to ensure that people are not just thinking about the presidential election, that they're thinking about the statewide elections and all the way down the ballot to the DA level, so that you're ensuring that the prosecutors who are actually tasked with prosecuting police, which if you elected different people, that would be done by an outside independent body. That was what the 21st Century Task Force on Policing report that was made during the Obama administration, that's what it said. But the first step is you need to elect a different person. In the meantime, though, I think you need to demand action in the short term. That officers need to be arrested. That's the first tangible piece to say, like, okay, we're going to start the process of accountability in this particular case and then move forward from there. We're in a moment as we sit here where that's still in flux. But I do think that elections still matter. I still believe in democracy. I mean, there are a lot of people who are on the left, you know, intersectional feminists who would not agree with me when I say, you know, it's all about the elections. But I do, Trump has been in there for one term. He has done a lot of damage, but we can fix it.
Yeah. And in your book, you spent a lot of time talking about the white moderate. And one of your, you know, you basically say you basically say being a moderate is not a virtue. And I think right now it's more important than ever to talk about that. So I think a lot of people are watching what's going on and they're saying, well, I understand that, you know, the police shouldn't be murdering people in the streets, but you shouldn't be looting. Can you, you know, I think some people think that that's a moderate perspective. Can you dismantle that?
Well, the thing is so funny about, you know, the people being like, you shouldn't be looting, or like the protesters are being violent. I mean, everybody should just stop. The reason why protesters are on the street is that because the police were violent. The police are not a neutral arbiter in who is violent and who is not. So the police are showing up at tanks dressed as G.I. Joes. Do they look like peacekeepers to you? I mean, for me, I just think it's completely ridiculous. And we do this every time. They show up with tanks and we're like, let's see if they can calm the peaceful protesters by throwing tear gas into the crowd. And let's see what happens. And then we watch it all play out on TV. And I feel like it's such a distraction from the fact that it's the police that need the reform. The protesters are there because they want reforms in the department that's tasked with keeping the protests peaceful, but they were the ones who were violent. So I think a lot of people don't realize that by sort of wringing your hands and saying, well, you know, in the 1960s, the protesters were nonviolent. I'm like, all you needed to say was that you've never Googled it, because you actually have no idea what nonviolent direct action means, what actually happened during the civil rights movement. And the fact that for every march you saw Martin Luther King arm in arm with other ministers, there was a Bloody Sunday picture with Black people running away from dogs and getting hosed down. That was also happening. So, you know, even in my own family, my aunt and my grandfather both marched in Selma in the third march. So if you watch the movie, there's three marches. In the third one, there's the Bloody Sunday. They tried again, didn't go. Third march, they were successful. My family participated in the third march. And my aunt was 17. She hid from the Klan the night before the march because they were going through looking for marchers to kill and murder. And so the idea that, you know, when you're going out to protest for your rights, that there aren't going to be these other forces that absolutely do not want you to get those rights, that are also working, you'd be completely, you know, delusional to think that that's not happening. So I want people to realize that there are people in the streets. You know, there's going to be a lot of analysis as to who those people are and who is organizing them. A lot of them have white nationalist ties, white supremacist ties. I mean, there's a lot going on in terms of stuff that we aren't seeing on our TV screens. And those people are contributing to the violence. But the equating of the violence that were committed, the violent act that was committed by the police and somebody breaking a window of a Target, that's just, those two things are never going to be the same. Target has insurance. Target's going to be okay.
Hmm. Absolutely. And in your book, in my work, what I try and do with masculinity is show to men that they have a gender in a society that has not taught them that they have a gender, and that has affected the way they were socialized, and that the same structure that hurt women, the patriarchy, also hurts them. And in your book, you talk about how ignoring the privileges afforded by whiteness has been detrimental to everyone. So how are white people losing out by not joining the fight?
Well, one of the things that's so obvious to me is that white people are losing out because basically what's happening is by the powers that be, if you will, dividing us along racial lines, the billionaires can just rob the piggy bank. They can take all the money. The billionaires made $500 billion during the pandemic. And so it's like, no, that's looting, right? That's looting.
That's looting, exactly. And so, I was gonna say.
Taking a pair of sneakers and also shaming, having people acculturated in a capitalist society, basically spending billions of dollars marketing to them that they need these sneakers to be happy. And then we're shaming them for stealing the sneakers when they had an opportunity during the pandemic where 40 million Americans lost their jobs. So let's just reflect on that for a moment.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. I was actually just looking at the definition of looting today. It says it also is referred as sacking, ransacking, pillaging, the theft of taking goods by force, which is stuff that white people have done throughout history. So language really matters here. So I now want to pivot to us doing some hard homework together.
For today's hard homework, I wanted to start with a quote from your book. It's actually the first line in your book. When you're accustomed to privilege, equality feels like oppression. You write that white privilege is a paradigm or concept that many of us have heard before, but it's necessary to unpack what it means in relation to white identity politics. When you've only known privilege, any righting of the ship to a course of equality for all feels like you're losing control of the wheel.
So the invisible knapsack, if you're not familiar, is a really neat and useful term that was pegged by Peggy McIntosh. And it's basically what white people carry around all day, every day, since the day that they were born. And it is, the privilege of not being followed in a store. It's a privilege of your behavior not being used as a reason to make a statement or make a generalization about your entire race. There are so many ways that it operates in our lives, and the best way for me to actually think about it is the way that my friend Rachel Sklar has often said, which is, privilege is like oxygen. You don't see it unless it's gone. So today I thought that it would be really useful for us to unpack our invisible knapsacks, and particularly for the white people listening, how important it is for us to do this today. So the exercise I want white listeners to do is to finish this sentence. As a white person, I have never been asked. So that's the writing prompt that hopefully leads to, it could lead to a sentence or it could lead to many pages that you can write down. For me, just to keep it short, one thing that I've been really reflecting on is that as a white person, I have never been asked to speak on behalf of all of the people in my race, ever. I can be seen as being interested in race without that being seen as me being self-interested or self-seeking or having an agenda. And the important thing that I would love people to do at home is that after that writing prompt, right? So as a white person, I have never been asked, whatever comes through for you when you're doing this exercise, to make sure to use what you have uncovered or what has been revealed or what is really crucial in your writing that has shown up for you, and to turn that privilege into amplification or into correction of structural inequalities. And so if for me, I've noticed that as a white person, I can bring up race, and it doesn't punish me to bring up race in a way that for people of color, there's a lot of data out there showing that even in the workplace, there are actual repercussions to them bringing up diversity issues in the workplace. So as a white person, I don't have those repercussions. And so it is on me to use that to activate diversity conversations in my workplaces and to encourage other white people to do it as well. So I'm going to use that privilege towards dismantling the power structures that gave me that privilege in the first place.
I like that prompt because one of the things I was thinking about is like things that I have to do that I know probably other people or like things that I'm asked that I know other people aren't asked. You know, one of the things that came to mind first when you said that was when I was in college. I don't know if like folk, like what generation folks are, but if you've ever seen the movie Higher Learning, Ice Cube's in it. Fun fact. There's a moment where the campus police like stop the black students on campus and they're like, let me see your ID. And Ice Cube's like, let me see your ID. And so I feel like I reenacted this every day in college at Tufts University. Mm-hmm. Like literally I would be in my track uniform. I'm like, first of all, our colors are brown and blue. No one would buy this for fun. And so I am wearing a Tufts track. It's brown, walking around campus. Why would I just be walking around if I didn't go here? And then at a certain point, you're just like, I'm a junior. You should know me by now. I'm not going to show you my ID. I am a student. Hmm. I'm like, I'm the captain of the track team. Like, and you're asking me for my identification as if I am some sort of like, you know, invader or I'm a trespasser on campus. And so that's the thing that probably white people don't have that experience. But no. I frequently had an experience. I mean, it happens in different contexts, but you frequently are questioned if you are supposed to be where you are. So that's the thing that I think is something that that white folks probably don't have to think about as much. Like being, you know, being in a room, being invited to some sort of big meeting or something, and you're sitting there and everybody's looking at you like, are you somebody's assistant? You're like, no, I'm supposed to be here.
I mean, like my friend Heatha Herzog once told me she used to work in finance, and she was in a meeting and someone thought she was the cleaning staff, like, or, you know, basically she said that that's why she has to dress a certain way and go above and beyond in terms of the way she dresses, because she'll get, you know, someone will be like, are you here to clean something? She's like, no, I'm the boss. Like, I set the meeting.
That was a scene on Scandal with Kerry Washington. I believe it was an episode where the people came in the kitchen and they were like, hi, Olivia Pope. And they went to Abby, the white woman with red hair. And she's like, I'm Olivia Pope. You know, that was supposed to signify that moment that we all have where people assume we're not in charge. And we don't have any authority. So that's just, that's one of those microaggressions, right? That's not something that I'm like thinking about at night. That's not something that's I'm crying in a puddle about. That's not something that is, you know, anybody's life is over, but it does build up. So when you see people going out into the streets because our lives are devalued to the point where you can snuff us our lives out with no consequence, you know, that's on the far end of the spectrum, where, you know, the very minor end of the spectrum is people always questioning whether or not you're where you're supposed to be. And if you're not where you're supposed to be, and that person has authority, like say it's a police officer, then you're in real trouble. And you can see how you can get from, you know, the very, you know, smaller microaggression end of this of the spectrum to like really overt actions and racism. So it's just something we all have to think about.
And I would argue being told that you don't belong is not a microaggression. That is the biggest form of aggression that I can think we can experience as human beings. That someone to constantly made to feel that you don't belong, and for people to question that you don't belong, it is a fundamental violation of people's humanity. And it shows up all the time. It shows up in many different ways, and there's nothing micro about that.
Right.
And so we should all, you know, I think in an instance like that, tell me if I'm wrong, but if there are white people around, they should be volunteering their ID, or they should be asking, why aren't you asking me for my ID?
Right.
You know, I think those are the small, you know, things that white people can do, and to put into action that allyship, and that's super easy, right?
I do have one other suggestion.
To say something.
Yeah.
What?
Well, I have one other suggestion that you made me think of another thing that happens often. So when we used to be able to leave the house before quarantine, and we used to go on airplanes and trains and be in airports and train stations, I dealt with a lot of microaggressions because traveling as a Black woman, I'm like a little bit on the younger looking side. So like, I definitely don't look like I'm a serious person that matters to most like business travelers, right? And so you're thinking of like, you know, more affluent white men, business travelers, sitting in first class, sitting in business class. This is the, you know, last year was like the first year, like I get like a Sky Mile, you know what I mean? Like I can't use it now, which is very sad. But one of the, it's so sad. I don't know where what we're going to do with those, but I'm super privileged, but like, anyway, point is that, you know, the airport is one of the places where I really need people to be more aware. I know we are all very stressed out. First of all, we're all very stressed out. So everybody is not their best selves in the airport. No one of any color is their best selves. But I do need for people, like if you see, and this has happened to me at least 10 times, so I'm going to say it as if this is a thing that happens all the time because it's happened all the time.
Yeah.
If you see a person of color, particularly a black person, could be any person of color, but particularly a black person, and most of the time, black woman, get just blatantly cut, blatantly like pushed out of the way, you know, to the side. This happened to me all the time where like I'd be on the line because like, you know, you fly Delta, you're standing on the thing, you're waiting, like following the rules. People just walk, they go, they just don't see you. They don't see you. You're completely invisible. It's like, it's wild because it's like, I'm here. I made it matter. I'm literally not invisible. I'm like, sometimes I'll say to people, I'll say it a lot, am I invisible? And they're like, no. Wow. And I'm like, well, why are you treating me like I am, right? Mm. So I just be aware of those moments because I've had situations where other white people that were on the line saw what was happening and then stood up for me. And I know how that feels versus where people stare at their phones out, you know, and pretend like they don't want to get involved. It really helps in that moment. You don't have to make it a confrontation, but just be like, oh, hey, like line's back here. So then at least like you have some backup. Like I need white people to back me up sometimes. I'm not saying that is not the solution to racism, but it would be helpful. And not just in silly examples like the airport. But I think that, you know, you're seeing this in a very serious way. You're seeing this in the protests. You're seeing white people put their bodies in front of the police and protesters. And it's that use of your privilege to actually use your privilege to help somebody who is of color. That is, I think that's the critical component that we're missing on a daily basis. Like people just always thinking about how they can, you know, just help the next person that is with them.
Yeah. Yes, thank you, Jelena Maxwell, for joining us to do some hard homework. I'm really, really eternally grateful for your friendship, for your work, and for the time that you spent with us today. So everyone should go and pre-order your book and run to the bookstores. Hopefully they'll all be open by July 7th when her book comes out. again, it's called The End of White Politics, How to Heal Our Liberal Divide. And it is out this summer, and I can't wait to read it, and I can't wait to see you.
We can all go outside again.
I know, one day. And it'll be so, I think, beautiful when we all do, and we're all going to celebrate and rebuild a better world together. So
I'm gonna hug everyone. I'm not even a hugger. Now I'm a hugger.
God, yes. I'm gonna hug the shit out of you when I see you. Now that I know, I really can't wait to see you. And thanks so much.
Thank you.
Hard Homework is created and written by me, Liz Plank, and is produced by Ashley Bearden.